more of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Tyke. All this week, we are talking about what many have described as the skills gap that's opened up in this country, the disconnect between employers who have jobs open, many in highly skilled manufacturing trades, and the millions of unemployed or underemployed people in this country. We hear business and political leaders alike talk about the challenges in finding qualified workers to fill the positions in a rapidly modernizing work environment. But Peter Capelli says it's not really accurate to call it a skills gap. Capelli is the author of the recent book, Why Good People Can't Get Jobs, The Skills Gap, and What Companies Can Do About It. He joins us on the line from Philadelphia, where he's a professor of management at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business. Welcome to Lake Effect.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Why do you think that the traditional narrative of the skills gap in this country, that there are lots of unemployed people and lots of jobs that aren't being filled, and that for some reason these two groups just aren't connecting, why isn't that necessarily the most accurate picture?
Because there's really no evidence for it. There's no evidence on any side of it. You know, if you look at the people who are unemployed right now, these were folks that were employed just a little while ago. It's not as if we've had this big structural change in the economy in that certain industries have just disappeared and other ones are booming, right? So you have to ask yourself, you know, what has happened that suddenly made these people unemployed? And, you know, we know what the answer is. It's just a decline in demand, the result of a banking shortage. When you look at the, you know, complaints that we can't find people to hire, the usual second part of that is to say, and the reason is, you know, schools are failing. But if you look at what people want to hire, what is actually in scarce demand, it's not entry-level skills. It's not that they're trying to hire people out of college and can't find them. Now, when you look at what hiring managers say in studies, you know, that ask them the questions, they're never complaining about academic skills. The extent to which they have complaints about new hires, it's complaints about things that older people always complain about younger people about, that they're not conscientious enough, they're not diligent enough, you know, all that kind of stuff. And if you look at the jobs that companies want to fill and the things they can't fill, and this is the key point, they're always jobs that require 5 or 10 years of experience. So what's in short supply is experience. What employers can't find and what they want is somebody who's currently doing the same job they're trying to fill right now someplace else. And, you know, that obviously would create kind of a problem if the only people you're willing to hire are the people who are currently employed someplace else. You know, you're going to kind of bid the market up. You know, wages haven't gone up yet, but that's, you know, that seems to be the story.
You write about something called that you call Home Depot syndrome. What are you getting at there?
Well, I think it's this model of the way the workplace works, which is, you know, is not true, but it's a pretty common model. And this model is the idea that, you know, organizations, companies, or any other organization that's an employer, they have jobs, and the jobs have very rigid descriptions, and we need somebody who has C++ programming skills, and they have to have 5 years' experience doing this. And it's kind of like the equivalent of a 3/4-inch bolt, you know, and that you'd go to Home Depot and you'd find that 3/4-inch bolt and you'd put it in and the thing would run. And if you had a, you know, a bolt that was a little bigger, it wouldn't run. A little smaller, it wouldn't run. And that's the idea many people have of the way job market works. And there's no truth to that whatsoever. If you look at any job, even in the same organization, you'll see that the people currently doing that job have very different backgrounds, different education experiences, different years of work experience. You know, there are lots of ways to skin a cat. We also know that when the job market gets tight, job requirements fall. That is, if it's hard to find people, employers start saying, you know what, we could do this job with somebody with a little less skill. And the other thing we know, of course, is that you could hire people who have basic skills and train them. You could always do that. That seems to be what has fallen off the map here, and that is a big problem not just for employers, but also for individuals, and I think ultimately for society. You know, if you're a new person entering the labor market, and every employer wants somebody who has 3 years' experience, and nobody wants to hire anybody and give them initial training, then we got a problem, not just for new hires, but for the economy, because, you know, the level of skill never goes up.
Right, and you write that there's kind of a modern spin on this, and that is how the automation of human resources is affecting this gap, that it isn't even necessarily people who are making these decisions.
Yeah, I think that's right. A lot of people want to blame human resources for a lot of these problems, and I think, in fairness, it's not the fault of any people in human resources. It is because the human resource function has largely been gutted in rounds of restructuring and downsizing. One of the departments that has gotten hit the worst for quite a while now is human resources, and in particular recruiters, the people who used to sit with a hiring manager and say, okay, tell me what you think you need for this job, and the recruiter would push back on them a little bit and say, you really don't need a PhD for this job. I understand you want one, but you really don't need it, and it's going to cost a lot of money if you ask for that, so, let's be realistic. And then they would also look at the resumes of people, and they would do some interviewing, and they would figure out, in particular, if a person had the right abilities and skills that may be acquired through two or three different jobs, that they could see how they fit together and would allow you to do the job. That's the human judgment. That's kind of gone. Those people have been squeezed out, so now you get hiring managers who have a wish list of what they would like in a candidate, and it goes from there to applicant tracking systems. So this is the software systems that screen. They used to screen resumes, but now nobody submits a resume. You've got to basically submit an application online. And the company or the hiring organization is trying to figure out whether you have the right stuff to do the job based on a series of, computer-based questions, which is pretty tough to assess. And so what they typically end up doing is saying, the real way we can be sure you can do this job is if you've done it before. But even then, we're not completely sure because you may have done it a while ago and, the jobs have changed. So the best predictor is whether you're currently doing the job someplace else. And so, that's what you see a lot of the software screens out, So as a result, it's quite often the case that nobody makes it through the applicant tracking software. So I had somebody wrote me a note about their company where they had 29,000 applicants for an engineering position, and none of them made it through the applicant tracking software. So at the end of the day, the system told them nobody was qualified to do that job out of the 29,000 applicants, So that's part of the problem.
The other part of the narrative that we often hear is that there is something unique about this point in time, that innovation is, growing by leaps and bounds and training isn't there yet. Do you have a sense for the historical perspective on the current thinking in terms of skills? I mean, I think I know where you're going. It seems like innovation would have always outpaced training.
I think there's a tendency for every generation to think that what's happening to them is unique. And as far as we can tell, looking at reasonably objective measures, in modern times, the fastest period of technological change was the 1960s. And if you think, oh, this is such a period of uniqueness, remember back to the period around 1912 or 1910, where in the space of 10 years, we got airplanes, electricity, cars, telephones, all that stuff in the space of 10 years. And frankly, the move from a laptop computer to a tablet computer is not an earth-shattering event, And for most of the people who are thinking about IT, actually, IT has gotten much easier to use than in the past, right? Now the software allows you to do all kinds of things on your cell phone that you used to have to pay a programmer to do. So, if anything, technology has gotten easier for people to use.
The other conventional wisdom you challenge is the notion that students emerging from secondary schools and colleges aren't well prepared to enter the workforce. How does what you see differ from that sort of generally accepted concept?
Well, the first thing to note is that, frankly, nobody is interested in hiring those people anyway. What employers say they want and they can't find are these people with job experience, extensive job experience. There's no doubt that there are plenty of college kids who are smart, graduating and can't find jobs. The issue of whether schools are failing is really the story, right? You hear that schools are failing and therefore kids aren't qualified. Well, you might argue that schools are not doing well enough, and I think you could certainly have that argument, but there's no evidence that U.S. schools on average are failing. In fact, all the objective evidence over time suggests that things are getting better. Now, they may be getting better slowly and not fast enough, but there's no falling off a cliff. They've actually gotten better. And in many ways, the biggest problems have gotten better, particularly dropouts, right? More kids are finishing school now by a lot, particularly in the African-American community. So, you know, the idea that they're falling off a cliff, that's not true. I think the extent to which we have a problem in the U.S., I think it's actually at the post-secondary level, where we have sort of thought, the conventional wisdom was, you know, that's where we're terrific in the world, you know, best schools in the world. The problem we've got is people aren't graduating. We're sending a huge proportion of high school graduates into four-year colleges, but a big chunk of them never graduate, you know. And so that's a problem because it's chewing up a lot of resources. And in the schools, the colleges, once they get there, they're spending a lot of time taking remedial classes, which basically repeat high school courses, and then they don't graduate anyway. So that's, you know, that is a real problem we've got, but that's not the problem of the conventional wisdom. The conventional wisdom is, you know, schools are failing, K through 12 schools. And remember, that story is all a story about the average, right? And so the best schools in the U.S. are absolutely world class, and the worst schools in the U.S. are absolutely third world, you know? So even if you think that the story is high schools are not doing very good job, the story is really at the bottom end of that story. It's not all schools are doing poorly.
Well, and I think people might tend to conflate education with training, and you write a lot about training, that this isn't really so much a skills gap as it is a training gap.
Yeah, I think it's not an education gap, that's for sure. It's a training-related gap. What's in short supply, as I said before, is 3 to 5 years of work experience. What is also in short supply are those skills that you learn only on the job, like electricians, craft skills, technicians, that sort of stuff. It's hard to learn to be a plumber in a classroom, right? And, you know, even though vocational schools can produce those sorts of folks, it's much better, and it's hard to get good at any of those things unless you get work experience. And, you know, work experience requires employers to be engaged in this. One of the great tragedies, you know, in the workplace with respect to skills issues is the collapse of apprentice programs in the U.S. We were never all that good at them compared to other countries, but they've almost completely disappeared now. And as a result, you know, we have this problem of how are we going to, you know, where are we going to get our electricians and our plumbers? It's hard to learn in a classroom. So by default, this is all being pushed onto places like our community colleges. The community colleges are, you know, struggling for money because they're funded by state and local governments. And, you know, in the U.S., education in general is almost a completely state and local responsibility. So state and local budgets are squeezed. The community colleges are cutting programs at the same time that everybody is turning to them to get the kind of skills that employers used to provide either on the job or in their own training programs. And, you know, at the moment, the practical problem is community colleges have nowhere near the amount of resources to do that. The longer-term problem is that classrooms are just not particularly good ways to learn these skills.
So would you say, is this all on the employers in your eyes? Do they need to go much further than they are currently to close this gap that they perceive?
Well, I think the gap that they perceive is driven by changes in the way employers operate. A lot of that change is driven by the fact that, you know, lifetime employment or long-term employment is gone. And part of that has been the related point that employers increasingly hire from the outside to meet their skills rather than growing people internally. And partly because of that, and they're afraid they might lose investments, training programs, particularly training programs for school leavers, you know, where you would hire kids out of school and turn them into managers or turn them into skilled workers, those things have largely disappeared. So the fact that employers are having a problem in not finding what they want from the workforce is due to the fact that employers have changed first what they're asking for. They're no longer asking for smart people and they'll train them. Now they want people who can hit the ground running without any training. And second, they're not providing any training. So it's hard to imagine how this problem is going to be solved without employers engaging it. Now, that doesn't mean employers have done this on purpose or that, you know, they're bad guys that, you know, tried to sabotage the workforce in the U.S., I don't think that's the case. But on the other hand, it's hard to see how this problem is going to be solved unless employers engage in it.
Well, is it likely to be solved, and are employers likely to engage in it until the bottom line starts being impacted? Because I think one of the things you write, and one of the phenomena that was reported in the latest, I think it was the Manpower Talent Survey, is that a majority of the companies that were experiencing this perceived skills shortage didn't perceive any impact on their bottom line.
Ah, that's interesting, isn't it? Well, I think to some extent, the part of the problem we have comes from accounting systems. That is, the way companies govern themselves, which is largely and perhaps appropriately by financial measures, internal measures. And those measures are not particularly complete. So, for example, in most organizations, if you've got a position that's open, a vacancy, if you keep it unfilled, it looks like you're saving money. It looks like it's improving your performance by leaving positions open. That can't possibly be true, right? If it was true, then you'd be better off just shrinking your organization down to nothing. But because the accounting systems are not good enough or complete enough to track things like lost opportunities, we find ourselves distorted in the way we operate. So, you know, if I'm a company, I got a vacancy, I'm looking for somebody who's perfect, as they say in IT, the purple squirrel, candidate that's just perfect and never seems to exist. It's saving me money to not fill the position, so why should I bite the bullet and hire somebody less experienced or hire somebody and train them? I might as well just keep looking and see if I can eventually find that person. And the other problem we've got is that in most companies, they, because their human resource function is gutted and partly because they don't have good metrics on any of these human capital issues, even though this is where all the money is, they have no way of thinking about whether it's cheaper to actually train somebody than to pay higher wages and, you know, bid somebody away from someplace else. It's astonishing what companies don't know about their human resources. I frequently ask this question of executives. You know, I ask them, do you know what it costs you if you have an inventory buildup? Yeah, we know that. What happens if parts are short, you know, are in short supply? Yeah, we know what that costs. Do you know what it costs you if an employee quits? No, we don't know that. Do you know what happens if you have a vacancy that's not filled? No, we don't know that. Do we know whether it's cheaper to make talent or buy it from the outside? We don't know that either. So, you know, that's part of the problem, is that they're not thinking about these questions in terms of rational self-interest, which is exactly what we always assume companies are doing, but in this case they're not.
Well, so to go back to an earlier question about whether there's anything unique about this particular situation, I wonder, were companies in the past more eager to or more likely to feel fine about training their employees and spending the money? Is what's unique about this the reticence of employers to spend the money to do on-the-job training?
Well, it certainly, that in and of itself would probably solve the problem, right? If employers were hiring people out of school, training them, growing them from within, that would solve the problem. There are lots of reasons why employers are not doing that, and that has to do with things which aren't necessarily within their control or completely within their control, the way they're thinking about it. It is worth pointing out, though, that there are employers who still do train people. And if you think about this in the white-collar management ranks, if you look at professional services, for example, law firms, accounting firms, the fields of medicine, for example, those places take kids out of college and they turn them into consultants in 5 years, and they turn them into accountants, and they turn medical school graduates into real practicing doctors and law school graduates into practicing lawyers. And they do it and they make money along the way. For the most part, you know, like in the consulting firms, they hire these kids and they turn them into consultants or accountants, and then they lose them in 5 years. So one of the objections you hear from employers is, we can't train anybody because if we train them, they're just going to leave and we'll lose the investment. Well, you know, the consulting firms, the accounting firms, professional service firms, they figured out that you could train people and still lose them and still make money. And the reason is because they figured out that you can train people on the job by doing real work, you know, and they've got this mix of, you know, a little bit of classroom training, a lot of work experience, some supervision, coaching, and mentoring along the way, and they can do it. So it's not an insolvable problem.
Well, Peter Capelli, I thank you for shedding some light onto what the possible solutions are.
Good. Thank you very much.
Peter Capelli is the George W. Taylor Professor of Management and Director of the Center for Human Resources at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business. He's also author of Why Good People Can't Get Jobs, The Skills Gap, and What Companies Can Do About It. There's more of our conversation and links to all of our Project Milwaukee reporting and interviews at WUWM.com/Project Milwaukee. That's also where you can find out how to attend this week's public forum on the skills gap at Milwaukee Area Technical College. Members of the Milwaukee County Board of Supervisors will hold their own public forum this evening on the county's proposed budget. We'll talk with the chairwoman of the board when Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio.